Hello, I'm Oliver Wang.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, that LP that has burned something deep into their memory. And today, we are going to be talking about Simondi's self-titled debut album from 1972.
Heat Rocks Podcast is a safe space for music enthusiasts. For music snobs, there are other places to hang. To that end, if you've not heard of Simondi, no problem. And no judgment. Your self-titled debut, released in 1972, didn't make a splash like other UK sounds. They came in peace, but meant business where the message was concerned. A message of brotherhood, freedom, some parts spiritual jazz, some parts just spiritual. If you're into gumbo, then the band in this album is all you. There's folk and rock, soul and spoken word, meditations and libations. For now, also know that what we're talking about is St. Vincent, Guyana, and Jamaica funk. That's what it is. Let it get into you.
To talk about Simondi, we invited Lucas McFadden, better known as Cut Chemist. Since the early 1990s, he's been one of the premier mix masters, selectors, producers, and all-around good dude to come out of the L.A. hip-hop scene. You may know him from his work with Jurassic 5 or Ozu Motley, or his DJ mix tours with DJ Shadow, or his own solo career, the latest capstone being his new album, Die Cut, which just came out this March. Cut Chemist, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
You know, we were talking before we started taping about what other albums you might have been interested in talking about, and you basically said this was the only one. It was the Simondi debut album. Why is this album the only one that you would want to get into?
Well, because it was the album that I loved the most, and I felt like, you know, when you dig through music and you have other friends who dig through music, a lot of what you're going to find is a filter of other people's tastes going, hey, you know what? You should listen to this. You might like this. You might, you know, that one's whack. This one's good. And a lot of my digging experiences have been that. And Simondi was not that. I stole that record.
Oh. Statute of limitations probably were probably good.
Probably apply, but only, I think, to a certain dollar amount, which I exceeded.
Yeah.
In 1987. And I was told about this record by a couple of B-boys in New York City record store called High Tech. And it was on Bleecker. Good Chiba Chiba. Chiba Chiba. And it was one of these short-lived record stores. I was out there, I was 15 years old, and they played me the Paul Winley 12-inch of Simondi with Smokin' Chiba, and it was $15, and I was like, oh man, that's got to be rare. It's too much money for me, though. And then I thought about it the next day, and I went back to go buy it, and they said, sorry, a Japanese gentleman came in here and bought it.
Of course.
And so that was my first experience of going, damn it, the Japanese came in here and bought the record I wanted? What the hell? What are they doing with my records? And so later that year, I found a copy of the album.
Yeah.
And I acquired it. And all I knew was the song Bra. This was fairly early. It was 1987.
Yeah,
and so I fell in love with another song, and it was after I was done with Bra. I was like, okay, that's cool. What else is on this record? And I found The Message.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what? The people are sleeping. This is the song
right.
to love.
Right.
And then from then on, I just found a new song to fall in love with, you know, Zion I, Rickshaw, I mean, and then of course, when you get into the song Dove,
yeah.
It's just, it takes a long time to just deconstruct why one would love that song, because there's so many different parts to love.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I just realized that it was a perfect album that I kept listening to at the most, you know, I probably really fell in love with it the most around that time that I was discovering Dove, was a few years later, in 1990, 1991, when I was graduating high school and moving into college.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of having a spiritual shift and responding to more of that element of that album than funky breaks and loops and stuff.
If you can, just for a moment, take us back to, I mean, you would have graduated right around the same time as me. So what was like an 18, 19-year-old cut chemist getting into besides basically having her life altered by Sumande?
And theft.
And theft. Yeah.
Record theft.
Record theft. In 18, 19, so okay, let's go back a few years. And, you know, when I was 14, 15, I was taking trips to the East Coast with my family.
Mm.
My sister was going to school at NYU, and so we would visit every summer. And I would bring blank tapes, and while they were going to see a play or something, I would be in the hotel room recording Chuck Chill Out and Red Alert.
Wow.
Shows as they were happening.
Let's jump back into the Friday Night Master Mix Dance Party with Chuck Chillout and Dougie Fresh and the Get Fresh crew on KISS FM.
And even taking the train to places like Queens and trying to venture out a little bit further. And so it was always a pilgrimage for me, because coming from LA, and I just loved to research New York hip hop, I always looked at the backs of records and see who was involved, write those names down, and have a laundry list of names to look at when I went record shopping in these cities on the East Coast. And, you know, back then you could carry on 3 crates of records on a plane and bring it home, and it's no big whoop. And I would bring them home and be the only kid in school that knew. I didn't even have anybody to talk to about this kind of stuff, because they didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I found the record that Jam Master Jay uses in Peter Piper, but also Grandmaster Flash uses in Wild Style in 1982.
The official adventures of
the Grandmaster.
You couldn't find high school friends to talk about this with? I'm so surprised.
No. My high school friends didn't even care that I had the It Takes a Nation album like 6 months before it came out. You know, they were like, you know, well, they'll probably care now if I tell them, hey, remember I had that on tape before you guys? And they were like, no. But yeah, so I was always that guy that, you know, studied music and, you know, I loved this culture so much. I wanted to get to the epicenter of it and extract as much information as possible to bring it home. And, you know, I don't know, just, I wasn't producing at the time, really. I mean, I guess I kind of was in 88, but not to the point where I thought it was going to be a career. It was still just a hobby. So what was I doing with this knowledge? I don't know, just the fact that I loved it.
And what kind of knowledge were you getting from the Sumande album?
So the Sumande album was a non-academic, no, you know, it wasn't left brain at all. That was the thing about the information that I was going after in the 80s about these hip-hop records. It was all very catalog-oriented and you know, I have to fill the void of this. I had to be a completist.
Mm-hmm.
Sumande was more of a time when I was kind of discovering a lot of new things in life, a lot of new music. The live circuit in L.A. was really happening for me. I met Will Dogg in 91.
Mm.
And he was playing bass in a punk band. And so there was like this weird hybrid of funk, punk, rock in LA. It was a very interesting time. Section 8, Miles' band Incline, Jane's Addiction, Red Hot Chili Peppers. There was all these amazing experiences, and there was something about fusing genres together that, mm-hmm. You know, it went far beyond Walk This Way by Run DMC. This was like L.A. skate street culture meets funk meets punk. And it was really interesting to me. And there's something about Simonde that kind of mirrored that somehow a little bit. And I think it was the fact that they were fusing different genres together.
Right, right.
I couldn't really put my finger on, you know, like I could the information of this rap record in the 80s where it'd be like, this, that's what it is. I need it. Bag it. Store it. You know, as Tony Stark would say. This was like, wow, is this African? Is it like a little bit Middle Eastern? Is it reggae? It's all of those things. But it fuses it in a way to where you can't really discern one from the other. You don't know where one stops and the other begins. It just all blends uniquely. There's so many pieces of that album that I explored and took time with and then went on to another part of it and went on to another part of it. And it took me that long. And I think that's one of the things that made that album timeless for me. And that I kept going back. And not only that album, but the follow-up albums. But I still go back to that first album, and it is the one. Yeah, so that's pretty much why I call that my favorite album of all time.
Wow. High praise.
High praise. In preparing for this interview, you know, I was thinking back to, you know, hearing the record, and I wanted to pitch it for something I was working on.
Yeah.
And listening through, I was like, oh, that's ambitious and that's not going to work. In thinking about it, I thought, this is not what I would envision funk to be. To me, it's not a straight-ahead funk album based on my own experience with funk.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that it's categorized as funk because to me, it's so much other stuff mixed in.
I agree.
Which takes it away from the funk that I grew up on.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly talking about later stuff. I'm talking about the Barqués, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about Graham Central Station, stuff like that. This is completely different to me. It leans very heavily West African. So if you could just sort of like let folks know, like, what makes this a funk album? What am I missing?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think a lot of the elements that categorize it as funk is the fact that it was embraced by hip hop DJs in the early days. And if that hadn't happened, I don't think that people even would put funk on that record.
Sure.
Yeah, I would think that would be more of a jazz record than a funk record.
Right.
Right.
And
the background of the core musicians were they had jazz training.
Absolutely. And West African music training.
Yes.
And, you know, talking to Steve Scipio, you know, he talks about all that, about the band circuits that they were in and out of before the band actually solidified. And I can't remember who they were playing with, but I was asking him about the Middle Eastern influences, like the flute in the in Dove, or the horn in The Message. Which gets into like very Snake Charmer kind of land. And he's like, oh yeah, that was all like coming up through this circuit, you know, kind of thing, and fusing it.
And there's such a Caribbean influence. So Jamaican to me, so reggae. I'm just steeped in a real true funk tradition. And so when I think about, I'm thinking about, like I said, the Barqués, the Ohio Players, Brass Construction, and this is completely different to me.
Yeah, well, you gotta, you know, what era are you talking about also? Because, okay, so Simonde, you know, the music we're talking about is like 72 to 75. I mean, it's not going to be anything that like you can put with Parliament, Chocolate City on over, but you know, I think you can definitely pit it against Barqués late 60s, early 70s stuff. I'm trying to think of other albums I bought with it, you know, certainly James Brown records.
Which they were clearly, I mean, people like Patrick Patterson and Steve Scipio, the two main co-founders, I mean, they're absorbing all of this stuff.
Absolutely.
Right, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, being in the UK, it was all happening.
What really stands out to me about Simonde is that they are a group, you know, everyone in that group are immigrants to Great Britain. And I think one of the differences in thinking about Black American musicians and Black British musicians is that most Black American musicians came to the U.S. through slavery, whereas most Black British musicians came there as immigrants from the West Indies. I mean, it all begins with slavery in both cases, but that what to me I hear reflected in Samandi Samande, I never know how to pronounce it properly, but what I hear in their music is them drawing from this incredibly diasporic and very immigrant heritage in terms of the way in which they're bringing all of these influences from the Caribbean, from West Africa, from the United States.
The closest thing I could think of maybe from the British scene would be Asagi.
Mm.
Telephone girl, I've got your number. You've been recommended to me. You won't spend tonight in slumber. Gonna send it through right through me. I'm a businessman.
You know, that's kind of close to Samandi, but not even really close, because they depart from that whole like Afro rock scene and get into something way more spiritual. Plus, I mean, talking about you know, the musical influences, one of the guys is from Guyana, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's that whole thing. But yeah, I mean, when you, the things that I hold near and dear to my heart about Samande is I'll tell you right now, is the song Dove. You can hear everything you love about that group in that one song. Might be the one you were talking about trying to place, because it is really cinematic. And
yeah.
People I know in film have always responded to that song. Like, you know, it's like a 7-minute journey. It actually does sound like you're flying. Like, you are a dove in that song. It's very impressionistic. And, yeah, it's you know, I'm the kind of guy that wants to see pictures when he hears music, and that's what happened when I heard that song. You close your eyes and you're just, you know, when it takes off and the guitar's going, you're just, you're soaring, dude. You're like in the clouds. And not a lot of music can take me away, like haven't, you know, take me out of myself and put me into a fantasy world. But that ultimately is what I want, because when I was a kid listening to music, that's why I listen to music. I listen to the Star Wars soundtrack because I wanted to watch the movie over and over again, but I couldn't.
Yeah.
So I had to just put on the record and imagine the movie. So at an early age, that was what I used music for, was to watch movies, kind of imagining movies in my head. And this Dove song did it.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It just didn't work for... Which was heartbreaking. I'll find a place for it.
Yeah,
if you're listening
to
music supervisors, please don't beat me to it. I got dibs on that thing.
Hey, Steve, you're about to get a placement.
it just didn't work out. One of my favorite songs on the album is "Listen."
Oh yeah, it's great.
Listen, brothers. Don't you think I'm trying to put you down?
I like the message of "Listen."
Mm-hmm.
I like the pace of "Listen." I like the subtlety of "Listen." So we usually ask what the fire track is. What the fire track is, that's my fire track.
Oh, okay.
What's your fire track, Leon?
Well, like I said, I went through different periods where I went through each song on the record and went, that's the one, that's the one, that's the one. But Dove for sure is the one that sticks with me the most. The message is pretty close as well. And then what's the one? Is it down, 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 down? Zion I, there's something very tribal about that one.
Yeah.
You know, it's just flute and like big tribal drums and chanting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess I love Zion. I like "Listen" because it's subtly spiritual.
Yeah,
Zion I is overtly spiritual. Two different sides of the same coin.
Right, exactly.
"Listen" is subtle; it sneaks up on you.
Yeah, right.
And I love that about the song.
Yeah.
What's your sleeper track on here? What do you think when people listen to this album, the one that they'll miss?
Probably "Listen." I think that took me a while to get to that one.
Really.
But you know what, actually, I think Rickshaw. Is the sleeper song for me, because I kept going by it and I'm like, I got enough to deal with. I don't need to be listening to Rickshaw. But then I needed to be listening to Rickshaw all of a sudden, and I really loved it. I don't know. I just felt like I was in a Rickshaw.
Rickshaw's a banger, though.
Yeah. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, that's great.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Cut Chemist about Simondi's debut album after a brief word from a couple of our other favorite Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
The Dead Pilot Society podcast brings you hilarious comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Aubrey Plaza, Andy Richter, Paul F. Tompkins, John Hodgman, Adam Scott, Molly Shannon, Busy Phillips, Tom Lennon, Anna Camp, Laurie Metcalf, Felicia Day, Michael Ian Black, Adam Savage, Paul Scheer, Ben Schwartz, Skylar Astin, Mae Whitman, Josh Molina, Ben Feldman, Nicole Byer, Jason Ritter, Sarah Chalk, Steve Agee, Jane Levy, Allison Tolman, Danielle Nicolette, Casey Wilson, Anna Ortiz, Lorraine Newman, June Diane Raphael, Kieran Shipka, Ed Week, Zach Knight, and Carrie Kenny Silver, John Ross Bowie, Jamie Denbo, Janet Varney, Alexander Torsani, Ellen Morales, Matt Worley, and many more. Listen at MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you download podcasts.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my friend's favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. You're hearing the voices of real litigants, real people who have submitted disputes to my internet court at the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I hear their cases, I ask them questions, they're good ones, and then I tell them who's right and who's wrong.
Thanks to Judge John Hodgman's ruling, my dad has been forced to retire one of the worst dad jokes of all time.
Instead of cutting his own hair with a Flowbee, my husband has his hair cut professionally.
I have to join a community theater group.
And my wife has stopped bringing home wild animals.
It's the Judge John Hodgman podcast. Find it every Wednesday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Thanks, Judge John Hodgman.
Yo, we're back on Heat Rocks, talking Simondi's self-titled debut album with none other than Cut Chemist.
If I could spin us back to the message for a moment, mm-hmm. is that I think of all of the songs off of here that probably have has traveled the most, that might be it. And I think partly it's the kind of the catchiest in a more of a conventional way of the songs on there. And what I find remarkable is you will find the most random covers of the message show up, especially in Latin America.
I know, maybe. It's the strangest thing.
Yeah, at least three different covers.
El Salvador, yeah. Panama, and I don't know, there's probably a Brazilian one. There's even some like killer Jamaican ones via probably, I think, the UK.
Yeah, what do you think is it about the message that caught the desire for groups to cover it? Because I mean, there are a lot of amazing songs on here, but that's the one that other artists decided, yeah, let's do our version of that.
Do you think it might be the turnaround? Do 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 do. Like, who doesn't want to cover a song that does that? You know, it's just so inviting. Like, okay, it's here. You take your turn at it. Because that's always, it's almost like Sissy Strut. You know, it feels like do 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 do.
Yeah, yeah.
Very similar. And then every group, like nobody does it the same. Not, you know, there's no two groups out there that can do it the same. A lot like Sissy Strut. No one's ever going to do it like the Meters. You know, I don't care how hard you try. I don't care how funky you think you are. You can't do it. And the message is the same way. I'm not just saying that other versions are not as good, because that Panama one is fire. It's incredible. They're all good because it's a great song.
Yeah.
But no one's going to do it like Simondi.
You're all up in my psyche because we keep talking about songs that I wanted to place, and I also wanted to play Sissy Strut, but that also didn't work out either. So, listen, if you're listening to this right now,
you need to just get on the program and play these songs.
I do, mm-hmm. But that's one of the books. I wanted to ask you a question, Oliver, because I know you have interviewed the band, and I wanted to ask you about sampling and how they felt about sampling, because of course they've been sampled by like hella people. What's their feeling about sampling? Are they embracing it, or are they like, yo?
So yeah, I got to interview Patrick and Steve for Rolling Stone a few years back, and I did ask them about the sampling thing, and this was Patrick Patterson's answer, which is, quote, "I think sampling is a great thing personally. I think the creative process is such that young players can hear something in a piece of music and can make that evolve into something new and fresh and vibrant. That's great. The only concern I would have, and many would have, is ensuring that intellectual property rights are observed."
Oh, yeah.
Which is to say that sampling is great as long as I'm getting covered. Paid for that.
And then, you know, I can dig it. You know, that's, we all want everybody to get a piece. It's just be findable.
I'm wondering from you, Cut, you know, given your relationship to an album like this, for example, have you ever sampled Simonde? And would you not, simply because of the relationship you have to it? Like, are some things too sacred
I think all the early Unity Committee demo tapes samples at least one of every song from Simonde's catalog.
Never mind that.
I mean, I did Fug. I did not do Dove, oddly enough. But I did Going Down. I did Zion Eye. Made a beat out of those. Bra was touched too much, so I left that alone. and then I think I definitely sampled pieces of Rastafarian folk song.
When I was a scalpist man, everybody loved me name. Now I am a bedded man, nobody knows.
We need to hear this, some of this demo stuff.
Yeah, man. Yeah, no, it's good. I'm trying to think if we actually cut vocals to the Zion Eye one, because we used to perform it a lot at the Good Life.
Ah.
It was called Tuna 7 Chemistry, and it was, I remember the bridge goes into The Bridge by MC Shan. Like,
okay.
I thought, hey, how about if we make The Bridge? Get this, The Bridge. And they're like, you're a genius. Anyway. Yeah.
Any favorites out there, besides your own work? Any favorite samples, favorite uses?
My work would not be on any favorites list, but I thought the Fugees did a good job with Dove.
Oh, yeah.
I thought they did a good job
on
with that.
On the score, yeah.
Soldiers, right, left, right, left, right.
It's time I settle the score.
Left, right, left, right, left, left.
It's time I
left,
settle the score. Ripple to the rum to the rip, single.
I thought De La Soul did a really nice job with Bra.
Right.
Was it Change of Speak?
Yeah.
Once again, it's time to buy more soul. Flavor you will save it in your soul. Wax is distributed in Vinso. Just wash it in the
That was probably my introduction to Simonde, was listening to De La album.
Okay.
I didn't know about Simonde when I was listening to De La.
Yeah, it was interesting. So. In 84, when I just heard Chuck Chella go boom, 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 I was like, oh, that bass line. And then like 2 years later, 3 years later, I hear it on a rap record, and I'm like, that's that. And you know, I was just so obsessed with anytime I heard something twice, I was like, oh, got to find the original source. And and that was the basis of my obsession with everything. Also going back to kind of setting up the room of what it's like in 91, you know, I had dreadlocks, I was wearing ponchos, I was, you know, in community college and in a rap group that utilizes musicians like Will Dogg and a drummer, and in the punk scene and the rock scene, listening to The Doors.
Into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown.
And listening to like reggae kind of for the first time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, just trying everything out and buying a bunch of records. And also that was kind of my way of just being a sponge for new music, you know, listening to Rotary Connection for the first time, discovering Axelrod. All happened in around that same time.
Are there any bands now or any movements now that remind you of Simonde? Who now reminds
you? I think more. I think more so than ever. You know, like groups like, you know, when you get into stuff like Hydus Coyote and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Tune Yards, like 100%, 100,000%. You know, they're blending genres to the point where I can't even tell what they're pulling from, because they're, you know, we're living in a playlist shuffle society where it's just like people are listening to Sgt. Pepper with, you know, Gwar and you know, James Brown and like some French obscure soundtrack. And it's all filtering into their brain, and they're regurgitating it as things like these groups, which are churning out a weird chemistry of different sounds that come from I don't even know where. It's almost like Samandi like times 1,000 nowadays. To the point where, you know, you hear somebody doing something straight ahead and it almost feels cliche and cute. You know, like, oh, listen to this retro funk band doing funk, you know, but not really putting anything else into the mix. Sometimes that works, but sometimes it's boring. Mm. And, you know, I always have to have a little rock in there, you know, a little bit of guitar, a little bit of Bad Boy, you know.
not the puffy
variety. And I think today that I listen to a lot more music, new music now than I did like probably 10 years ago or even 20. Certainly probably like, I don't know, in that 90s period, outside of the rap records we were talking about before the interview, I wasn't really listening to any new stuff until 93, until the big wave of, you know, Nirvana and Alice in Chains. I mean, Mazzy Star and all that stuff. I was killing that. I still am. That's probably my most romantic rock period during my lifetime, you know, outside of living, listening to things that existed before my time.
And what's your lead-off single? If you're thinking about radio play then, what from this album is the one? If you're trying to pitch this to
the it would be The Message, you know.
Right.
That would be it. And you'd think that would be enough to get it, but they were probably like, oh, it doesn't sound American enough.
Right, right.
I bet you that was said.
Right.
100%.
Right.
Doesn't sound American enough.
A little bit too eclectic, I think, for radio play at the time.
Yeah, it's like, well, the reggae stations aren't going to play it because it doesn't sound reggae enough, and it's not American enough to play on a funk station, you know, with James Brown.
And then it's also a little jazzy.
And it's a little too, you know, yeah, and it's not going to, the jazz station ain't going to fly. So, yeah, it was like the first time you hear like a hybrid of music genres and they didn't fit into any box. And lo and behold, hello, that's the album Cut Chemist loves the most. Well, go and listen to Die Cut and you'll find out what happens when a guy really likes Samandi.
Oh, man, you were ahead of your time, your future thinking.
Well, I mean, I think it's boring to be pegged into a box and just be like, that's what it is and that's what it'll always be. You know, back then I made a choice probably because of this Samandi album that I said, that's not going to ever be me because it's not that and I'm responding to that. So, you know, that's why I got down with groups like Ozone Motley because, you know, is it a funk band? Is it a Latin band? Is it a rap band? It's none of those. It's all of them.
Yeah.
You know, and Samandi was a big part of, you know, Will Dog and I's kind of like connecting in the early days.
Will Dog from Ozone Motley.
Yeah, I would be like, dude, you got it. We'd be in my Honda in the front seat. He'd have his bass in the car, and we'd be listening to the tapes, the Samandi tapes, and it'd be like, dude, learn this bass line to Bird. Like a bird floating through the sky, I wish I were. Doom, 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 doom. Doom, 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 doom. The bass lines in Samandi, I was like, y'all are killing it, dude. You got the best bass lines out of everybody. That's what made their music so dope. They were, you know, it wasn't there as a reinforcement. It was just so melodic. And the chord progressions they would do with the bass was unlike anything I've ever heard. And all those songs, I was like, dude, your bass player should be in a castle. And that's either Steve or Patrick, I think. I think Patrick might be the bass player. Anyway, yeah, big up to the bass.
Anything that jumped out at you differently in listening to the album again in prep for this? What do you think you might have missed the first time you listened to the album? Any new insights?
Man, let me tell you something. I went through that record, and I interviewed them 2 years ago, and I did what you're talking about. I said, man, I got to listen to all their stuff. And just to make sure, you know, I know what I'm talking about. And I thought I was going to outgrow the record or not feel the same way I did when I first heard it, or, you know, in that romantic period, certainly in 90, 91. And that wasn't the case. I loved it just as much. Mm-hmm. And it just, and I could listen to it without like that nostalgic filter where I'm like, oh, I'm back in 1991 in my, you know, parents' place. No, this was like, I'm in 2016 at my own crib and, you know, I'm listening to this music with that filter and sure. It's still good.
Do you think that this album was right on time, ahead of its time?
Ahead of its time.
Or timeless?
Timeless. I'm going to have to choose timeless. I think that there are elements of that album that people still don't understand. Mm. And probably never will. Or it's one of those things where I don't think it's meant to be understood by a bunch of people at once. It's for the individual to discover and connect with. And I think that's what makes it timeless.
So we asked this of all of our guests. If you can describe this album in three words, what would they be?
Do 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 do. That bass line, come on, that's a winner. Not that that answers your question, but it just popped into my brain.
That was great to hear you sing, though.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about that song, it's like you're thinking of the keyboards, but it's that bass line, do 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 do. So funky. It's going up, you know, while the other instruments are coming down. It's like a crescendo and a decrescendo at the same time. Anyway, sorry, I went off on a tangent. Sorry, what was your question?
Describe this album in three words.
That's cruel.
Torture.
So does it have to be like, can it just be three?
Okay. Yeah,
yeah. A3.
Spiritual, transcendent, impressionistic.
Oh, see, there we go.
Good.
Boom.
Yeah, because, you know, because of that cover, it feels like kind of like a painting, like a little bit of, I can't remember, is it Manet or Monet? Who was the impressionist? I think it was Monet.
Monet.
You made a point earlier about, you know, black folks in London and sort of these diasporic sounds, and it reminds me a lot of a group called Bugs in the Attic, which is from West London, and their keyboard player is a guy named Kaidi Tatham, and he had an album called Agent K Feed the Cat. There's a song on there called Arms Are Day, which sounds like it could have been a bonus track on this album. It's, you don't know what it is, a little bit spiritual jazz. Mm-hmm. A lot of those guys are from Jamaica. Mm. I find that a lot of artists, especially some of those future soul artists from London, bring this sort of sound. They bring these influences, West Africa, they bring Jamaican influences all together. That's just their leanings, whether it be the drum patterns or the chanting or how they're singing. So if you're listening to this and you get a chance to check out that song, Arms Are Day, I think you'll find a bit of familiarity and similarity to this album. Mm. If they slowed it down a little bit and didn't have that ch-ch, it would sound like it belonged on this album. To your point, Oliver, there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That'll do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, Cut Chemist. His new album is called Die Cut, the first in, 11 years?
Yeah.
Cut, where can people find you?
Let's see. I'm always online checking my DMs personally. So you can hit me up on the old cutchemist.com/Twitter. The Facebook, the Instagram, and then I'm going to be on tour, continuing tour.
Thank you so much. This is really a really delightful conversation.
Thank you for having me. I love
Very
talking
nice
about
to meet
Samandi.
You.
Yes.
You too.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wang, and Morgan Rhodes. Our theme music is Crowned Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup. Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan Rhodes, along with Shannon Deloria and Kara Hart, both of whom engineer and edit our show. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and executive producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Max Fun family, taping every week in their studios in the peaceful Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles. We want to thank all of our 5-star iTunes reviewers, the most recent being AMVP and Ira Joel. Thank you so much for that. I know I say this every week and ask you all to leave reviews for us, but we are 100% serious when we say that this show builds and grows because people are able to find it on iTunes because of your reviews. So if you are, whether you're a longtime listener or a new listener and you think the show is the bee's knees, just take out a minute and go to iTunes and leave a review for us if you can. It is so crucial for us.
We also want to thank all of our social media fans out there. Thank you so much. We do appreciate the tweezies and the retweezies, especially from these folks. Cool Handle Luke, who's got the coolest. I mean, yo, it doesn't get better than that. Nice. Thank you so much for the tweezies. Done. Sam Rivera, KK Bracken, Young Black Fulani, a.k.a. Sway Kid. Thank you so much for shouting us out and spreading the word. All those retweets really count towards getting people to check out Heat Rocks. And if you continue to dig it, please do continue to spread the word in the form of tweezies and retweezies. Nice to see you, Oliver.
Nice to see you too, Morgan. And before we get out of here, we're going to leave you with a little teaser clip from next week's episode, which features Golden Globe and Oscar-nominated singer-songwriter Tara Stinson talking about Minnie Riperton and her album Adventures in Paradise.
One of my favorite things on all of her albums, if you listen to the long versions, there's like all of these little high notes or runs or little nuances at the end that they didn't clean up. It was just the fall off that you're like, I would just hang on the edge. I was like the kid where everyone's out at the skating rink or whatever. I'm like in my room like, oh my God. I think she said Maya right there.
Right.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.